But apparently these chickens really still like the big wattles and the big combs on the rooster. And so what you typically see in these feral chicken populations are these little roosters, but just like gigantic combs, because the ladies think it's just to die for. And I love that. I love that the ladies have a type.
Welcome to Science for the People. I'm Bethany Brookshire. For a lot of millennials like myself, it seems like so many of my friends are trying to recapture a more self-sufficient existence, especially when the pandemic kept us all so isolated. Maybe they start making sourdough or gardening more. And a lot of them, since 2020, have decided that what they really want to do is keep chickens. Chickens feel, in a way, like the most iconic parts of a farm lifestyle. Give them a little food, and they provide you with free eggs and eventually a rotisserie. But more and more people are studying the behavior of their chickens, bonding with them, giving them names. Chickens aren't just a food source anymore, they're pets. These people are, one could say, under the henfluence. That's the title of Tova Danovich's first book, Under the Henfluence, Inside the World of Backyard Chickens and the People Who Love Them. Tova is a freelance journalist who has published in the New York Times, the Washington Post, NPR, Eater, Vox, and other outlets. And somewhat unsurprisingly, she keeps a flock of chickens. Tova, thank you so much for being here with us.
Thank you for having me.
So I have to start by asking, did you bring a chicken to this interview?
I did not. They're all safely ensconced in their coop where they're being pretty loud this morning because it's the beginning of egg laying season again.
So you're getting lots of egg calls?
We're getting a lot of egg calls starting pretty much as soon as the sun comes up.
Lucky you.
No.
So it's very clear from reading your book that you are an animal lover. A lot of this is actually kind of about your personal journey keeping chickens. And I was wondering, why did you want to turn that into a book? Like, what made you go, okay, I'm an animal lover, but this is going to be the book?
When I first got chickens, because, you know, I'm a journalist, I love researching, my first stop was the library, because I'm going to read everything that they have about chickens and taking care of chickens. And I was still going through this giant stack of books at the Portland Library when I brought my first chicks home. And as I got to know both them inside my house close by and also them through the pages of these books, I felt like there was really something missing from what had already been written about them. You know, there are 12,000 approximately books on how to keep chickens, but not very much that looked at the very long relationship between humans and chickens, much less, you know, writing about who chickens were themselves. And I probably started falling a little bit in love with my chickens already, but I really wanted to read a book like that and felt like, you know, I read a lot of books about animals because, as you mentioned, I'm a bit of an animal lover. And chickens really felt like they were missing. You know, pigs had their own book, cows had their own book, certainly dogs and cats get lots and lots of books. And so it seemed like if the book I wanted to read was going to be out there, I was going to have to write it myself. So that's how we got here.
Bonus points for dropping the names of the pig and the cow book, because I want to read those.
I know there are a couple of cow books, but The Good, Good Pig by Cy Montgomery is a favorite of mine.
Oh, well, Cy Montgomery. Yeah, mm-hmm. Of course.
Amazing.
Okay. And one of the things that I really enjoyed about reading this book is that it is about the experience of keeping chickens, and it's kind of about the relationship between humans and chickens. But there are, shall we say, Easter eggs dropped throughout. I'm going to be making so many chicken puns. I'm sorry. Through this book, and just fascinating little tidbits of knowledge. And one of them is the phrase running around like a chicken with your head cut off, which is a phrase I use all the time. And I was not aware was actually a reference to a real event. And I was wondering if you could tell the story of Mike the Headless Chicken.
I know, running around like a very specific chicken with his head cut off. Poor Mike. He was a rooster who belonged to a farmer who tried to turn him into dinner one day. And somehow he managed to cut Mike's head off, but left some of, I believe what people think is like the spinal cord intact. So Mike stayed not quite alive, but also not dead either. He would move around, he would scratch, you know, go through the motions of pecking at least. And he was actually fed through a dropper directly into his esophagus and stayed alive for a number of months like that. This being kind of peak sideshow era, you know, Mike went on tour around the country to show off Mike the headless chicken to audiences who wanted to pay to see such a thing, I suppose. That's where this term comes from that we use today. And it unfortunately does not speak super highly of the chicken.
It's also just peak sideshow culture. Yeah. But yes, I was absolutely floored. And I was like, wait, that's a real thing.
Mm-hmm. And I love that, you know, Mike came from Fruta, Colorado, where they still have a Mike the Headless Chicken festival, and there's like a statue downtown
of a headless chicken
that's right next to a coffee shop too, from what I've seen on Google photos. I have not been there myself, so I hope someone reports back.
Please tell me that the statue is larger than life size.
It is.
Oh, it's that's big. Wonderful. So good. Okay, so as I mentioned, kind of at the top of this episode, people tend to turn to chickens when things get hard, specifically. And that has been true throughout things like the Great Depression, et cetera. But they also, you know, turn to chickens during COVID. The number of my friends who got chickens is really high. And I was wondering, why do you think that is? Why do people turn specifically to chickens when times are kind of tough?
It was such an interesting phenomenon seeing the COVID chicken boom. And, you know, so many people got into chickens that hatcheries actually sold out of baby chickens. Like, you couldn't find them anywhere, which was wild. Though, of course, it wasn't just chickens then. It was also dogs and cats and other pets, and the shelters emptied out, at least temporarily. So what we saw during COVID with the chicken boom was kind of an interesting mix of things. On the one hand, you had all of these people stuck at home who needed something to do with all of their time and, you know, maybe had been kind of thinking about getting chickens someday. And suddenly they have a lot of time to build a coop and raise some baby chicks and do all the things, or they have kids at home. So that was one side of people rushing out to get chickens. On the other hand, there were shortages of a lot of food. I mean, most of us remember the great toilet paper shortage of 2020 at this point, but a lot of other things on the grocery shelves were really hard to find, and food supplies were kind of rocky for a while. So a lot of what we see during economic downturns, or when inflation goes really high, unemployment is high, people turn to chickens because having a reliable source of food in the backyard makes people feel better. So that was another angle on the backyard chicken boom. Some of the people wanted them for pets, but some of them also wanted chickens because they wanted to be sure that they would always have breakfast in the morning.
Yeah, it's kind of I don't want to say it goes into the prepper mentality, but there is a certain like apocalyptic preparedness.
Definitely. And it is funny because, you know, preppers are such a far extreme version of that.
Right.
But I think most people do a little bit, you know, having like the tomatoes in your garden and growing vegetables, another thing that was very popular during lockdown. These are all things that I think maybe it just gives us comfort as humans to feel like we can take care of ourselves a little bit when something in the world is pretty rocky.
Which is really funny to me because I am, in fact, a gardener, and you get maybe like three meals out of that at yeah. best, and they're not filling.
And very expensive.
Also. Yes, so much more expensive. So we were talking, there's been a rise in suburban chicken keeping. But you note in your book that in some areas that is illegal. In a lot of like suburban areas. What are people worried about? You know, what are some of the laws around chicken? And is that different from laws around like cows or goats?
Well, I mean, cows are just too big to keep in backyards. I can't think of any urban or suburban area that would allow a cow. Goats are also kind of, you know, that middle zone. But a major problem with chickens is that they can be loud. A lot of people are also worried about smell from animals, and that can be a concern, though, of course, if you like keep your coop clean, they really don't smell very much at all. Mostly you're smelling the hay. But I think the noise issue is a big one. And then people also worry about rats. Rats in the city, as you talk about in your book, they're a major pest. They're all over the place. And even though rats are around us all the time, they certainly love a nice dinner of chicken feed that's left outside all the time. So it's not that having chickens brings rats that, you know, weren't already there, but suddenly you might start seeing a lot more of them around your place if you're not taking precautions. So rather than have to deal with people that maybe get in a little bit over their heads with the backyard chicken enthusiasm, some cities have just decided, I don't want to deal with it at all and make it illegal.
Well, and it's not just rats. If you're dealing with suburbs and exurbs, raccoons love chicken eggs.
They do.
Raccoons, foxes love chicken. Bears love chicken.
Everything
fried
loves
or not.
Chicken. Yeah, my first advice I always give to people when they ask, you know, what do I need to know if I'm getting chickens? And I say, get a predator-proof coop, because the worst possible thing that can happen is to get these chickens. You're so excited to have baby chicks. You've, you know, raised them for weeks until they're old enough to go outside. And then a predator comes and destroys your, you know, online purchased coop overnight and massacres your flock. And that is not fun for anyone.
Least of all the chickens, I would imagine.
Yeah, least of all the chickens. It's just bad news all around.
So when we talk about suburban and exurban chicken keeping, I feel like we also need to talk about who is keeping those chickens. And I was wondering, did you talk to anyone for the research for this book around the cultural issues around the keeping of chickens? So for example, it's against my town's ordinance. Part of that is people, for example, the people of color who live in my town, to them, yard chickens are a sign of poverty. They are not cute back to the landness. And so I was wondering, who is keeping chickens and kind of what does that say? Is there a diversity issue in who wants to raise backyard chickens?
It's such a fascinating question. And of course, backyard chickens being kind of a newer pet on the scene, there's not a lot of great data for it other than the fact that all signs point to the fact that it is increasing. I think the American Pets Product Association has done some of the best recent studies on backyard chicken ownership, and they found that in the households they surveyed, it had increased from 8% to 13% between 2018 and 2020, which is tens of millions of people. It's a lot of people keeping chickens, but of course, who those people are, whether their flocks are 6 chickens for backyard pets or 50 chickens that they are, you know, selling the eggs or doing a small business, that's totally up in the air. However, I would actually say that chickens are quite a diverse pet. I mean, a lot of people who maybe feel they don't have the money for a cat or a dog that, you know, doesn't give you anything in return, but you're going to have to pay for food and vet bills, they feel like they can afford some chickens because at the very least, they're they're contributing to the household. I mean, back in the day in America, a lot of enslaved people who were forbidden from having like horses or cattle or pigs or even dogs, they were allowed to have chickens. And they were similarly something that a lot of women raised, including my grandmother and a lot of other like farming families in the Midwest. And these chickens were how women paid for household expenses, which weren't just clothing or school books, but also sometimes food for the family. I mean, chickens have been hugely important economically to a lot of people that didn't really have a lot of power in American society. One of the things that's been the most fun about researching this book is whenever I mention that I have chickens to anyone, and literally from anywhere all over the world, they'll start telling me a story about someone they know who keeps chickens. And maybe it is like their friend with the fancy backyard coop, but often it's someone who's parent, you know, has cockfighting chickens somewhere or kept chickens as farm animals back home in Puerto Rico. And like the sounds of chickens that are feral nearby reminds them of home. Chickens are small and they're portable, and we've had them for 3,500 years or so with us. And every culture in the world has chickens. So I think it actually is like surprisingly diverse, even though when we think of the backyard chicken movement, we think of very affluent people with space in their backyard and, you know, money for the very expensive coop and fancy breeds. But while that's part of the story, I don't think it's the whole thing.
And you mentioned we've had chickens for 3,500 years or so mm-hmm. now. What do we know about where chickens came from? Like, what is the OG chicken?
Yeah. So in 2004, the chicken was actually the first farm animal and the first bird to have its genome sequenced, which is why we know as much as we do about where these birds came from. So like all birds, you know, they at one point were dinosaurs and broke off and descended down the line. And chickens are in the genus Gallus, which is just four type of what are known as jungle fowl. The domestic chicken mostly has red jungle fowl genes. The red jungle fowl live in Asia. They're dwelling in the jungle. They like a shrub and a bush and generally warm weather. And at some point, people, most likely for cockfighting and religious reasons, actually started keeping these birds close to them. And we domesticated them, and they got a little bit bigger and fatter, and they laid more eggs. The jungle fowl only lays about 10 to 15 eggs a year. The domestic high production chicken breeds lay like 300. So there have been some pretty large changes over time. But yeah, they're all just a subspecies of jungle fowl, mostly red, but a couple of other bits mixed in.
That's really fascinating that you say they only produce 10 to 15 eggs a year. Mm-hmm. And for many birds, 1 to 2 is a good year. So like only 10 to 15, you know, to those of us who eat a lot of eggs, that's mm-hmm. like, oh, that's not very many. But I mean, imagine being pregnant 10 to 15 times a year.
I know. I had to look it up, and I talk about this in the book, that I think each egg is something like 3% of a chicken's body weight, and had to do the calculation for what that would be for, you know, a pregnant person giving birth 5 times a week or whatever it is. And not comfortable, I'll say.
Oh my goodness. I'm so glad that you did that research, though. That was my question.
To know. I think it was something like the equivalent of a 5-pound baby if you're the average sized American woman. Just too much baby.
And so you mentioned they were originally potentially bred, we think, for ceremonial and cockfighting purposes. How do we know? Like, is there archaeological evidence of that? Are there like ancient chicken feather outfits? Like,
yeah, I think it is mostly from archaeological evidence. There's, of course, a lot of fighting about this. I mean, when I started working on this book 4 or 5 years ago, the estimates were more like 8,000 years ago that we domesticated the chicken. And I think halfway through the research, the new best estimate was 6,000. And then just last year, as this book was going to print, another paper that seemed to be better than the ones that came before has this 3,500 year estimate. So things are always in flux, especially with something like this that happened so long ago and in so many different parts of the world. But we certainly see, you know, when you look at like ancient Greek and Roman myths or pottery, there are a lot of images about fighting roosters, not very much about the hens. Chicken meat certainly was not very popular until recently.
And you mentioned that they spread around the world. And, you know, if we think of chickens as originally a form of the Asian red jungle fowl, mm-hmm. Where did they go from there? Or was there more than one domestication event that we know of?
I believe the current theories is that they were domesticated from these red jungle fowl, which were in one area of kind of Southeast-ish Asia, and then spread from there. But I mean, chickens went everywhere. The Polynesians, when they were traveling, they had chickens on their boats that they brought. There are old stone coops on Easter Island that people have found that used to house chickens. It's pretty incredible how much they show up in different places. Even the Egyptians had early form of incubators that they built using fire and, you know, clay, almost ovens that they built where they could keep these eggs warm, and humans would go in and turn them by hand so they could hatch out a number of chicks at once.
That's wild. They're ancient Egyptian incubators. Yeah. That's amazing.
It's really amazing. I mean, the early incubator actually for human children was built off of the chicken incubator. Someone saw these and said, what if we put babies inside of them and then put them in a sideshow in Coney Island as a tourist attraction until this like took off? It's pretty incredible the ways that chicken and human history intertwine.
Do we know anything about when kind of eggs and chicken as a food started to kind of rise? I mean, you know, you need eggs, for example, for cakes. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, do we know kind of when that usage for chicken started to emerge, like after cockfighting and using mm-hmm. feathers and stuff?
That's a really good question. And I don't think I have an answer specifically on when that became more popular. And I would imagine that given chickens had spread to so many places, they probably became more or less popular in different places at different times. I will say that until really the early 1900s, most people raised chickens for eggs. That was the main thing. We had dual purpose, or what we now consider to be dual purpose breeds. So they would both lay a decent number of eggs. And then when they were done, or if they were roosters, you could kill them for meat. And that was the case for hundreds of years. That was just the most practical kind of chicken to have, was something that could do both. And it wasn't until we started industrializing farming, we learned more about how to make commercial incubators in the early 1900s, and that's when we started separating them into egg-laying chickens, which made people think, what if we also do meat breed chickens? And it was through having these meat-producing chickens where they grew really, really quickly and had, you know, the large breasts and thighs and all the pieces that we're used to seeing at the grocery store, that chicken really took off. It was definitely not a popular meat until about 1930s or so. It's very recent.
Yeah, I wanted to actually kind of take a side quest into that, because one of the other kind of tidbits that you mentioned in the book that was news to me. We're used to eggs year round, mm-hmm. but eggs are seasonal. Chickens are actually not supposed to lay in winter.
I know. Isn't that wild? I didn't know that until I got chickens and then was doing all this reading. And I'm in a lot of backyard chicken groups on Facebook and things like that. And every winter without fail, someone who's new to chicken keeping will have these posts that say, what's wrong with my chickens? They were laying, you know, 5 eggs a week and all of a sudden they stopped and I don't know what's going on. And you get hundreds of comments from people that, telling them about, you know, winter break. So the egg laying of chickens is tied to how much light there is. And I think it's roughly 12 hours of light a day or so triggers egg production. And so when it's less than that, they just stop. They go on winter break. You know, their bodies take time to regroup. So when we started getting these year-round egg facilities, and also with, you know, electricity becoming more widespread and less expensive, people just started putting lights in the coop, and then they kept the chickens inside all the time so they could kind of make it artificially spring and summer for these chickens all year round and keep them laying.
And of course, I mean, the winter break makes a lot of sense when you realize this mm-hmm. is like 5% of a chicken's body weight.
Yeah, exactly. You know? I mean, it's not great for them to be laying so many eggs all the time. But also, you know, if the point of laying eggs is to hatch out chicks and you have these little helpless things that are relying on the hen for warmth, like, you don't want those to be hatched in February. That's not good for anyone.
Yeah. And so you were started in a little bit on this, but I'd love to get some more detail. You mentioned that, of course, before about the 1930s and 40s, people raised chickens. If you wanted eggs, you raised chickens. Mm-hmm. What kind of triggered the rise of the industrial egg industry?
It's super interesting. And it happened in Petaluma, California, which I have a lot of family in Northern California. So I had been going there for years. And suddenly it got a lot more interesting and exciting when I was researching this book. And I noticed that a lot of the buildings have like eggs on them or chickens, and they're like the faded signs for old egg companies that no longer exist anymore. So there were some people in Petaluma that developed the first commercial incubator. This meant that they could incubate, you know, 450 to 600 eggs in one go, compared to, you know, the average chicken can maybe incubate about 12 under her body. That's a really big difference. And if you're waiting on a hen to incubate those eggs, you know, she has to be broody, which is the term we use to talk about a hen who wants to hatch out chicks and sit on them for a month at a time. So not having to wait for nature really opened the door. And these people started selling both the incubator technology and also incubating out a bunch of chicks to sell. So we had the rise of hatchery industries that were suddenly selling day-old chicks to various people, and also building really large flocks of chickens that would lay eggs. Petaluma is pretty close to San Francisco, and so they would just send the eggs down the river and sell them for a lot of money. They actually referred to Petaluma as the richest little city in America. And it was around this same time, too, that, you know, we had people like Darwin talking about evolution and Mendel and his pea experiments. And people were thinking about breeding, not just as let's breed the healthiest animal for the next generation. They were thinking about traits for the first time. And, you know, if we like blue coloring, what do we do to breed these animals together to get something that's blue? They said, we want chickens that lay more eggs. How do we get them to lay more eggs? And they started breeding together the ones that could produce the most eggs. In the process, interestingly, they got a lot of roosters who apparently were quite mean and no fun to be around at all, which is kind of the early version of what we refer to as the white leghorn chicken today. But as they laid more eggs, you know, their bodies got smaller and they got a little bit more useless for meat.
And so you end up with this fascinating kind of separation between egg chickens and meat chickens over time.
Exactly. Yeah, they're like completely different machines almost, which I think is an apt descriptor, both because of how we deal with farm animals in industrial agriculture, and also because of how much the breeding really just hyperinflates these specific traits on these birds.
So I wanted to go back a little bit to the red jungle fowl, because you have actually seen wild chickens in the form of these red jungle fowl, which are incongruously living in Georgia for reasons. And I was wondering, how different are the wild chicken and the domestic chicken in terms of their behavior? You know, we talked about how the wild chicken lays only 10 to 15 eggs a year.
Are they 10 to 15?
Yeah, poultry. So how else are they different?
I think one of my favorite differences between the wild chickens, or the wild jungle fowl specifically, and the domestic chicken is that the crow of the rooster is a little bit different. A biologist I interview in the book describes it as though someone has like strangled the rooster at the end. With the wild jungle fowl, it just kind of like cuts off instead of that cockadoodle too. So there are some slight differences, but one of them too is that they're much smaller than the domesticated chicken. I mean, there are a number of different breeds of domesticated chickens, and some of them do look more jungle fowl-like. But by and large, you have these kind of green and black and red roosters who are quite beautiful, and then these very drab hens. And both of them are pretty small. And being small and light like that allows them to fly. These are not migratory birds. You know, you're not going to see a flock of jungle fowl, you know, moving through the night sky or anything like that. But they can fly, you know, two or three stories high to roost at night. And that's how they stay safe from predators. And it's actually quite a beautiful sight to go out at sunset where you have these feral or wild chickens and see them all jump into the trees and, you know, jostle for the best evening's perch.
Yeah, I think it comes as a surprise to a lot of people that wild chickens and also wild turkeys fly, and they fly very well for something, a turkey in particular, for something around 25 pounds. They fly real good. Mm-hmm.
Peacocks too. Yeah, they can fly into trees to roost similarly, which how they do that with their tails is a complete mystery to me.
Very carefully. So you mentioned, you know, there's these kind of feral chickens that you met, and there are like domestic chickens. Do wild chickens, and I mean like the Asian jungle fowl, like, can they still crossbreed with a domestic chicken? Is there enough like genetic overlap there?
They can crossbreed. Yeah, the domestic chicken, Gallus gallus domesticus, instead of Gallus gallus, they're just a subspecies. So they can interbreed. And in fact, in a lot of places, people are worried that the, you know, pure red jungle fowl is going extinct because there are so many villages where they keep domesticated or semi-domesticated chickens, and then the wild chickens come out, the jungle fowl, and they interbreed, and that is diluting the wild chicken genetics, essentially.
Well, maybe we shouldn't breed such sexy chickens.
I know.
They considered?
One of my favorite details about the feral chickens, it gets a little confusing, but so we have the wild chickens, which, you know, initially the species that developed on its own from dinosaurs. We have the domesticated chickens, which humans got a hand in selecting certain traits. And, you know, they have some of those typical domestication qualities, like being friendlier and larger and having more offspring. So then you have the feral chickens, and the feral chickens are domesticated animals that now live in the wild. They are exactly the same. They just don't have humans taking care of them anymore, and they're thriving. And in places where people have been studying feral chicken populations, which sometimes do mix back with these wild chicken genetics, there are really funny things that have been selected for. So you see some of the wild chicken genes coming back into play, like the hens are more likely to become broody and they're smaller so they can fly. But apparently these chickens really still like the big wattles and the big combs on the rooster. And so what you typically see in these feral chicken populations are these little roosters, but just like gigantic combs, because the ladies think it's just to die for. And I love that. I love that the ladies have a type.
This makes me so happy. Yes, I was actually going to ask about those in Hawaii and how they have these extra sexy feral male chickens. Yeah.
Extra sexy just for the ladies. They're like going on spring break, having a great time.
So I was also kind of struck when I was reading your book is with the fact that we domesticated chickens a really, really long time ago. But because we mostly raise them in large groups and then we eat them, we don't actually know much about their health. At least vets don't really, like, you don't take your chicken to the vet. And I was wondering, how do people kind of care for the health of their chickens? Because it seemed like it was very kind of reliant on traditional knowledge and folk medicine.
Yeah, as I talk about in the book and also earlier in this conversation, you know, a lot of chickens were raised by people without a lot of power in society. And specifically in the United States, often a lot of women were the ones who raised and took care of chickens. Individually, a chicken is not worth a lot of money. So even if there is, you know, the local farm animal vet that will do a visit, hugely unlikely you're going to spend that money on an individual chicken. So what a lot of people did is, you know, they passed down this knowledge for how to treat these chickens. And there are a lot of amazing folk remedies, like, you know, chewing up some ivy leaves and spitting it into a hen's eye, or bringing them by the fire and, you know, setting on fire specific herbs that are supposed to be good for the birds. And a lot of this was passed down, you know, orally, or eventually when poultry journals started taking off in like the 1800s, early 900s, a lot of women would write in and give their remedies for how they treat chickens and make them better. It was really only once men started getting involved in the chicken industry and it became this kind of industrial commercial thing starting kind of in the 1940s, 1950s or so. That was when you start seeing commercial veterinary care happen. And that is on a flock level where you're, you know, dosing them all with antibiotics, you know, you're giving thousands of chickens vaccines at the same time versus this very one-on-one kind of folk medicine care that was literally just like old wives' tales passed down from one person to another.
Yeah. And here I should put in a plug for Maren McKenna's book, Big Chicken, which is specifically kind of about the rise of the industrial chicken industry and kind of the use of antibiotics. And we have talked about that on the podcast and we will link to it in the show notes.
Yeah. I love that book.
It's such a good book. So you ordered your chickens. You have chickens. How many chickens do you have right now?
I currently have 8 chickens.
8. Okay. And you ordered your original 3 through the mail. You can literally get a chicken by mail. And this was amazing to me. How does one mail order a chicken?
I know. It's wild that for the last like over 100 years, since 1913, people have been sending like thousands of baby chicks through the mail all across the country. And you had no idea, like they're just appearing, peeping at the post office. All that they do is they put them, at least today, in cardboard boxes with air holes and send them in the mail. Like you want it to be more exciting or fancy or like specifically tailored to the fact that it's a living animal, but they are just cargo that go on trucks and planes and back to trucks, the same as your Amazon package.
But what I found especially fascinating about this is that you can do this specifically because of a weird biological feature of the baby chicken. baby chickens do not need to eat for the first like 48 hours or so after they're born, which is why you can just literally shove them in a box and they will still be peeping when they get there. Do we know why they do that? Like, is there an evolutionary reason for chickens to not need to eat during the first 2 days?
There's a very good reason. It's because if you have a clutch of, you know, 10 eggs, however many, they don't all hatch at once. Each egg takes about 21 days to hatch, but they're not going to be, you know, within 10 minutes of each other. And the mother hen has to keep those eggs warm and incubating. She has to keep the baby chicks that have just hatched warm. So having to leave the nest to teach hatched chicks, you know, where to go to find food is going to leave those chicks that are still in the eggs in a pretty bad spot. So what evolution has developed as the solution is that the chicks get a first meal upon hatching, and that is essentially like the egg white. They eat before they leave the egg, and that is enough to keep them full for that like 48-hour period or so. So people in the early 1900s knew this. And they said, what if we put this scientific information to good use and started sending chicks like on the train to different places? And then when the post office started shipping packages around, they were like, sure, we can take your chicks too. And that's how it happened.
And as part of your research for this book, you did actually visit a chicken hatchery. I think it was one where you got your chickens. Is that right?
It was not. It was actually a different one.
Mm-hmm. What was it like?
It was really fascinating. I mean, it's a big, very nondescript warehouse. And there's, you know, the office out front that looks like every other office, which with a bunch of cubicles. And then you go behind this, you know, biological security door, and all of a sudden, everything is full of the sound of peeping, and it smells very weird and humid. I eventually realized that the smell I was smelling is the thousands of incubating eggs, some of which are not fertilized. And so they just sit there being warmed for 21 days, which is a very specific smell.
Delicious.
It's just delicious. I know. If you've ever wondered what an old, overboiled, hard-boiled egg smells like after 21 days, visit a chicken hatchery. So I got to go there. There are not as many as there used to be, you know, in the early 1900s of these chicken hatcheries, but they do still exist, and they are all over the country. And they are in the business of, you know, collecting eggs from chickens that are fertilized and incubating them and separating them and sending them to customers all over the country. Some people, you know, like to get their chicks from local farm stores, and they feel like that's a little bit closer, but those chicks were also shipped there from a hatchery. So unless you are, you know, hatching out or incubating eggs yourself in your backyard, every single chicken that you have is going to come from one of these places, put in a cardboard box, sent through the mail to your home.
And also, a lot of them come with kind of, it's not a guarantee, but they say there's like, most of the time, all you're getting are girls.
Mm-hmm.
All you're getting.
Yeah.
Are girls. And so it's, you also learned how to sex a baby chicken.
I tried. It's really difficult. There's a reason that there were hatcheries a long, long time before we started offering sexed baby chicks. Because chicks do not have external genitalia. They have a cloaca, which is just kind of a general purpose orifice. And when a chick is just born and that cloaca is still a little bit pliable, you can move it around in such an angle that apparently you can tell if there is a tiny, tiny little bump inside or not a bump. And that is all that they have to go on for whether these chicks are male or female. So I watch them try and do this. And if you are a chicken sexer as your job, like, you're doing this 8 hours a day. This is a long time of looking for this tiny bump in a tiny little like chicken orifice. I absolutely couldn't see it. I don't know how they do it. It's magic to me. But it's incredibly difficult. Even places that offer this service, it's like a 90% guarantee, and they just give you your money back if you're wrong, the like couple dollars you spent on a chick. But then you have a rooster that you have to deal with who, if you live in a city or a suburb, you have to rehome.
And I have to say, I was kind of surprised by this because we know that chickens have been bred for so many things, right? There are show chickens with like this interesting size and colors and egg laying habits. But most of the time, they actually do not breed them for things like easily discernible sex-linked color or something else more obvious than staring at a chicken's butt. Why? Yeah.
I mean, they do have a couple of breeds where you are able to do that in commercial hatcheries. They have chicks where the males are one color and the females are another because it's like a crazy thing to ask people to do all day long, especially if you're looking at millions of chicks like they have in the egg industry. So a lot of commercial breeds will do that. You can also breed in the ability to feather sex chicks where the males and females will have a slightly different wing shape. But that's only possible when you are breeding for that trait. And breeding for that trait, you know, you can't maybe get a chick that's really cute and fluffy or comes in fun colors or has a poof on their head. So when you want chickens to, you know, look a certain way or have something else going on, the easily sexable part kind of falls by the wayside.
It actually makes me wonder if CRISPR technology and gene editing could like help us sex chickens easier.
Yeah, I mean, people are looking into this, certainly in the egg industry. I mean, we have a laying hen population in this country that's over 300 million hens at any given time. And each of those hens, you know, once came from an egg along with 50% of the population for that round that were male chicks. You know, they hatch about 50-50. And because those chickens are bred solely for egg laying, the males are completely useless. And so they kill the males right after they hatch. This people don't like. The egg industry doesn't like it. You know, there is nothing good in the optics of we kill hundreds of millions of like adorable day old chicks just because they're boys. So people have been working for a really long time to try and figure out how to do in ovo sexing, where they can tell what sex the chicken is going to be before it hatches. But it's really hard to do that. And it's hard to scale it up to a degree where you would be able to do it quickly enough to produce the number of chickens that even just the egg industry in the US would need.
And yeah, that was something that really struck me when you visited the hatchery and also a couple of times later when you talk about battery chickens, et cetera. It was the waste, right? Mm-hmm. Half of the eggs don't hatch, making that delicious incubated smell. Half the chicks are male. Mm-hmm. Most don't want those. And you actually compare it, and I thought this was a really great comparison. You compare it to fast fashion, where so many garments end up in landfills, but these are literally baby birds. Mm-hmm. And the hatchery that you were at raises chicks for people to keep in their backyards, often because they believe regular eggs and chicken rearing are cruel. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering, like, did the amount of waste involved surprise you?
It didn't surprise me. And it is still something I really struggle with a lot because you're right. You know, a lot of people like myself get into this because we want chickens that are raised in a better environment than what like the industrial egg production system gives them. I mean, when you look at it that way, you know, we're awash on the cruelty and dying aspect with what happens to the boys, whether you get your eggs from the grocery store for $1.99 or you have a really fancy coop in your backyard. I do think beyond that, you know, they have a lot better lives, actually being able to like look at the sunlight and catch some bugs than being in a cage. But there are certainly a lot of things about animal agriculture, that are just difficult when you raise a living thing to be a commodity. This is one of the areas that I would really love to see people figure out how to do this in ovosexing. And there are a lot of people working on doing that, either, you know, gene editing hens, as you mentioned, so that they only have female chicks hatch, or there are also ways people are looking into using like light to look through the eggs to be able to tell what color that chick is going to be before they hatch, or something close to a pregnancy test where they are actually taking a small chemical sample from the egg and testing that to see if it has, you know, male chemicals or female chemicals, and then destroying the egg accordingly. But it's a really difficult question, and it's not a question that is unique to chickens. I mean, when we are raising animals on the scale we do for the number of people that we have in the world, you need a system that is going to be efficient. And those systems are really good at making sure that people, you know, generally speaking, have all of the food that they want all the time. You know, we don't have, at least in the United States, a lot of times when you're wondering if there will be eggs in the store or meat on the shelves or anything like that. But in order to do that, we have to produce more than is going to get there. You know, just to get milk, you have a similar issue where only female cows can produce milk, and they have to make the next generation of cows, and sometimes have male cows, which are useless in the milk industry. And that's where veal comes from. And you have these cows that are killed at a few days old. There's a lot of like inefficient things about having an efficient system to produce our food.
That was actually something that was really interesting to me, was in this particular inefficiency, it's the roosters that are not as valuable, right? Mm-hmm. And it's really fascinating because the roosters used to be very valuable. Mm-hmm. And so over time, you've seen the rise of the hen and kind of the decline of the rooster. And I have to imagine this probably makes a lot of dudes on TikTok very uncomfortable. and I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about why that happened. Why was the rooster such a big deal? And then not.
As we talked about earlier, you know, chickens were domesticated for their kind of more ritual significance. And roosters like to fight each other. My hens sometimes fight each other, but they're tiny little squabbles that are over very quickly. But even just that is legitimately very fun to watch. You know, they're funny. They flare their hackles. They jump around and flutter at each other. And then 2 seconds later, it's over. Of course, humans took that and took, you know, the slightly bloodier version that roosters do with their long bony spurs that they have on each leg, and turned that into a blood sport, which, you know, were very popular for a while in human history. And so roosters were kind of held up as this symbol of what it meant to be, you know, a good fighter and brave and manly and like all of the things that old human society really valued in that dichotomy. And you didn't really hear a lot about hens back in the day. You know, the one nice thing that roosters did and got credit for was they protected the flock. They, you know, look out for their ladies. They keep hawks from getting to them and sometimes give them nice morsels of food. So you also have some nice metaphors with, you know, the rooster as like good husband and good protector. But over time, as animals, you know, became something that was more commodified instead of, I don't know, something you raise really close to you, and cockfighting we started finding to be unacceptable, which is very fair. But then we were relying solely on the chicken's ability to be food. And it turns out that females are a lot better at doing that than the boys.
And one of the, I think, most fascinating parts of your book is the section on chicken intelligence. Mm-hmm. Because, of course, chickens have this reputation of being bird-brained, like so dumb that if they're staring mm-hmm. up at the sky when it rains, they're going to drown. Never mind that they won't, because their eyes are on the side of their head. So mm-hmm. if they're staring up at the sky, they actually... anyway.
Totally unfair.
Very unfair. But so... chickens are, in fact, one of the first animals to be clicker trained. And yeah, I love this.
I know. It's so delightful.
I will point out that before the chicken, there was the pigeon. Mm-hmm. Just because I'm team pigeon. So pigeons were clicker trained first. Just saying.
Pigeons are also great. All birds are good birds. yeah, you know, chickens are really good at being chickens. I think Ed Yong in his new book, An Immense World, right? He talks about animal intelligence and all of the ways that animals differ from human intelligence. And, you know, they're not as good at some things humans are good at, like physics, but they're really great at a lot of other things. You know, they can echolocate and they can sense like shifts in sound and in magnetic, you know, in the magnetics of the world that we just have no awareness of all of that happening around us. And I think chickens, like most animals, you know, the more time you spend with them and the more you study them, you don't think they're dumber. You just start realizing all of the things you were missing that they do really well. So chickens have a number of specific vocalizations that they use to alert when, you know, a predator is coming from the sky versus the ground. They can differentiate between these two things, and they can even decide if they're going to bother alerting the rest of the flock when danger is on the way or not, and protect themselves. These are all behaviors that usually we would think of being from a quote unquote intelligent species. It's a little bit more like humankind than a chicken. And yet here they are doing this. And we just had to bother to spend some time studying and looking at them. So yeah, back in the day, B.F. Skinner, you know, our favorite behaviorist, was doing this project where he was clicker training pigeons to drop bombs, which is a whole story that I talk about in my book. Everyone was very invested in science, in helping the war effort during World War II. And I guess if you are someone who works with animals, you find a way for animals to help in the war effort. And this is what he came up with.
Oh, they also tried dolphins. Deliver bombs. I mean, yeah, every amazing animal was gonna deliver a bomb at some point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, which really goes to show you how not good our equipment was at the time at delivering bombs, that we were like, maybe dolphins and pigeons will do this better.
I mean, to be fair, pigeons are really, really good at guiding stuff.
Yeah, exactly. And they were great at guiding across the room. The military just didn't believe in it. Who knows what the world would be like today? But yeah, so he had these two students that were working with him on this project. And when they had downtime, they were like, what else can we teach these animals to do? And so they were clicker training them, which if you have dogs, you might be familiar with this. I think some people don't know what clicker training is. But essentially, it's a marker that you use instead of saying, you know, good boy and giving your dog a treat when they do the right thing. You mesh the sound of the clicker with a good thing. So you click and then you give a treat. And over time, when the animal hears the clicker, they associate that with, I have done something well. It's kind of like a Pavlov's dog situation. So they discovered that they could do this with a whole bunch of animals, and it works particularly well with birds, in fact, and species that don't really care about doing things well for us, like our dogs do, because you can mark very specifically what the behavior is that you want them to do. So these two behaviorists, Marion and Keller Breland, were working with Skinner on the pigeon project, which sadly did not go anywhere.
And it bombed.
It bombed.
I'm sorry.
And they decided to start an animal training business of their own. And after trying a few things, what they hit on was working with a feed company to clicker train chickens to do these amazing little sideshow attractions. They would have chicks like running around in an endless circle and going down a slide. They would have chickens playing tic-tac-toe against people, and so on and so on, tap dancing. It's a wild time in American history.
The things people did for advertising before CGI. That is what they did.
And entertainment too. Like, let's go watch a chicken do a dance.
I mean, what do you do on TikTok now? Like, what do you do on Instagram now?
You know, maybe I should be clicker training chickens.
Like, we're watching squirrel obstacle courses, for God's sake. We have not changed. We've not changed.
It's just gone back around to the beginning. But yeah, so, you know, they were training these chickens and sending them out all over the place. And it was wildly popular. And thanks to people like them, you know, animal training became a lot more likely to use positive reinforcement and clicker training and treats instead of just like, let's hit our dog until they do the thing we want them to do, which is essentially what animal training looked like before B.F. Skinner came along. Some of this training, you know, has gone into things like training marine animals in shows at SeaWorld, which people are not a big fan of anymore. But it's also been incredibly useful and an overall good thing for, I think, animal kind compared to what we were doing previously. And a lot of it is thank you to chickens. So good job, chickens.
So on a little bit of a more serious note, you actually do cover what's called battery egg laying in the book, which is kind of how, if you're not buying pasture raised eggs, that what you're probably buying is battery eggs. And that's where, you know, chickens are crowded together and they kind of lay until they sort of like decrease laying, and then they are gone. Mm-hmm. And I was struck, you cover that, but you don't actually go into things like broiler chickens and how mm-hmm. eating chickens are raised. Why did you decide to focus on backyard versus battery versus eating chickens?
I think some of it is that I think there's been a lot of really great research and reporting about how broiler chickens are raised. I mean, not everyone reads everything, of course, but I think it's pretty well covered territory that, you know, these are birds that within 6 weeks of life are about 6 pounds and ready for slaughter weight for the broiler chickens. Way back in the day, spent some time at a farm animal sanctuary, and they would try to keep these birds alive past that 6 week period. And the only way to do it is by keeping them on diets forever, and like almost starvation level diets, because these birds are so efficient at putting on weight that they will do it to the point where they can't walk anymore because their bones can't support them, or they have heart attacks and so on. They're kind of just like incompatible with life. And I feel like because so many people talked about that, and I really wanted to show a different side of chickens, that even though I do interspersed throughout the book kind of give the big picture that like what's happening with broiler chickens, maybe not so hot, I didn't want to focus in on that. And I think conversely, it was actually very difficult to find information about the laying industry and how all of that worked, you know, how these birds are treated, what their lives look like. And that's because people haven't really cared. They haven't really thought about it too much. You know, 70% of the birds in the United States are in battery egg cages, and most of the remaining 30% are these cage-free birds, which are becoming more popular. But instead of being in small cages inside of a warehouse, they're just free inside of a large warehouse where they spend all of their lives. You know, they maybe get slightly more than twice as much space as the caged ones do per bird, but they're still quite squished, and they still can't do a lot of natural behaviors, and it's not great. And because so much of the, you know, quote unquote backyard chicken movement is people having eggs, I really wanted to talk about, you know, what life looks like for a lot of these birds that spend their lives laying all of these eggs that we just kind of take for granted. You know, a lot of people, even if they're vegetarian, like they still eat eggs. And clearly, like most industrial agriculture, there's still a lot of really sad things that happen in that system.
Yeah. And you note in the book, when it comes to things like animal welfare, or even actually climate change stuff, we tend to privilege mammals over birds. Mm-hmm. So for example, people will say that the climate impact of eating chicken is better than that of eating mammals, which is true. Mm-hmm. But also when it comes to things like animal welfare, we do tend to treat mammals differently. We don't really give birds a lot of credit for a deep interior life, And I was wondering, did you talk to anyone who is working in animal ethics or animal welfare about why that is, why we don't think of animals like chickens as having kind of interior experiences?
I didn't talk to anyone specifically, but I think it's something, I mean, I definitely talk about it a little bit just from my own feelings on the subject. I mean, I know the Frenchie is recently like the most popular dog breed in America. And I did do an article about them a couple years ago and why they're so popular. And one of the reasons people always give is that they're very human-like. You know, their eyes are on the front of their face. They make all of these different expressions and sounds. They're very baby-like. That's certainly the case with cows as well, which have, you know, these beautiful long faces and big eyes, and they can be a little bit more expressive. And a bird, by comparison, you know, they have a beak. Like, they can't smile with that. They can't do a lot of expressions. They haven't learned how to raise their eyebrows in the way that our domesticated dogs have over the years that they have been living amongst us. There's not a lot about the chicken that outwardly we can relate to as fellow mammals. And it takes a little bit more time to spend with them, watching them, you know, seeing the patterns of their behavior over and over, which I have certainly done in the way too much time that I've spent just watching my chickens and hanging out in the backyard, to start seeing that, you know, even if their emotions and the things they enjoy or don't enjoy, even though they express that differently from humans, there is still very much an expression of those things and an appreciation for the things that, you know, give them good lives.
So what do you hope that people will get out of your book? What kind of henfluence do you hope to have either on people who already keep chickens or people who don't?
That was something I thought about a lot while writing this book, because I read so many animal books. I wrote about food for many years and wrote about animal agriculture a lot. And so I knew the audience for this book would both consist of, you know, a lot of people like me who already have chickens, and your family and friends all know you have chickens. And so they see a chicken book when you go to the bookstore and they're like, this is the thing for you. And then there would also be people interested in animal welfare already, who already think that the way we treat a lot of animals on farms leaves a lot to be desired. And I wanted the book to be able to really meet people where they were in regards to their relationships with chickens. And I think what I would be happy with, whatever reader is reading, is for the book to just make them appreciate chickens a little bit more, to realize that, you know, these are animals that are equally fascinating as wild animals like wolves that have had so many books written about them, or coyotes, or dogs, or cats, any one of the, you know, very charismatic animals that we like to think about their interior lives and the way they live. I think chickens are just as worthy of our curiosity and our respect as those creatures. And I think if we all took, you know, a couple steps more towards being in love with the chicken, I would feel like I had done my job, regardless of where they started from.
Well, Tova, thank you so much for playing chicken with us.
Thank you for having me. It's been excellent.
Very good. If you'd like to learn more about Tova Danovich and her book Under the Henfluence, Inside the World of Backyard Chickens and the People Who Love Them, we've got links on our website, scienceforthepeople.ca. While you're there, you could give us a follow on social media, or even better, you could leave us a kind review on Apple Podcasts. It really makes a difference. We also have a Patreon, where if you are so inclined, you can support our independent podcasting crew with a monthly or one-time donation. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you next time on Science for the People.
Science for the People is listener supported. You can find us on Patreon, where you can support us with monthly donations in any amount. Your support keeps us afloat and able to keep making great new episodes, and we thank you for it. The show is produced by Rochelle Saunders and edited by Ryan Bromsgrove. We get help with special projects from K.O. Myers. Our theme song was written and recorded by Fractal Pattern, and its title is Binary Consequence. The show is hosted by Bethany Brookshire, Anika Hazra, Marion Kilgour, and me, Rochelle Saunders.